From the Cold War to propaganda and the deep state.
Pella Neuroth-Taylor
on today's News Talk TNT.
Welcome to the Pella Neuroth-Taylor Show on this Tuesday afternoon. It's Walpurgis afternoon, or Walpurgis night in Scandinavia, in the Germanic world, and in Eastern Europe. It's a big holiday over here and not heard of at all in France or the Anglophone countries. In Germany, it's called the Hexennacht. It's when huge bonfires are lit all over this region, and effigies of witches in some countries. It marks the end of the winter half of the year, the dark side, the witches' seasons, and welcomes the true spring. Although the northern half of Scandinavia is still covered in up to half a meter of snow, just a 3 hours drive away from here. But it's a very student affair. Many students' exams are over, and it's a night of drink and revelry. And after these witches' effigies have been burnt, the huge bonfires subside, and it's very sort of melancholic, but some also very atmospheric atmosphere in the place where I am at now. People sing nostalgic songs for when they are young, student songs. And tomorrow, of course, is Labor Day, and there's a constant battle in the media between those who want Walpurgis Night to be celebrated, which is traditionally a bourgeois thing because the students were from bourgeois backgrounds, and Labor Day, because tomorrow's Labor Day marches, 1st of May, the workers' movement. And the conspiracy theorists among the labor movement say that the bourgeoisie wants to get the labor movement drunk on the evening before so they can't march for their rights. Anyway, a little bit of a lesson there. We'll come back to witches in very short order. We've got Jasmine Dodd on as our first guest. She's reported on Harvey Weinstein's 2020 rape conviction and the overturning of that by the New York Court of Appeals, and gives maybe some hope for some of the Trump cases. If he didn't get a fair trial, how about Trump? It's about prejudicial conduct, including allowing women to testify about unrelated allegations. Jasmine is going to connect the two, and maybe that's going to be good news for Trump. Our next guest after that is Ulla Tunander, who's a friend and returning guest. He's one of Scandinavia's top security experts. And we're going to talk a little bit about Nord Stream and about what's next for Ukraine. After the hour, we've got Jeff Dornick, who's the CEO of Pickaxe, a co-founder of the Freedom First Network. He's a great fan of RFK, and we're great fans of JFK. On this show, though, we haven't talked about his nephew and his presidential campaign. Is his campaign going to favor Biden or Trump? Opinions go both ways. There are both good and bad sides about him, and we will talk about that too. Finally, we have Larry Schweikart, who's a top historian, and he's going to give us a rundown on a number of issues, including another of the cases that Trump's involved in, and whether Trump should be declared immune from prosecution in an election-related campaign. Anyway, we'll also be talking about USA's low birth rates, which are echoed all over Europe and the Western world, and whether the reports of the death of electrical vehicles are premature or whether they have a future, all that. And the usual news analysis with Basil Valentine, our political editor, coming shortly. But back to the question of witches, I just want to say a short thing here about we talked about Catherine Mayer yesterday, who's the chairwoman of NPR, which is National Public Radio, US state taxpayer funded equivalent to the BBC, quite leftist and liberal in orientation, which is even worse now under Catherine Mayer's control. She was past chief executive of the Wikimedia Foundation, and as one of our guests, Mike Waller, talked about yesterday, she had roots in a deep state and in color revolutions. And of course, if you control the media, as in the old cartoons of Latin American dictatorships controlling the radio station, you control the country. And people on the right in America worry what that betokens for the election campaign if you have this activist of the color revolutions in charge of this communications channel. But the point is, she has one of her top guests is Anne Applebaum. And I want to talk a little bit about her. I've known about her for 30 years. We moved in the same circles. We were both in Eastern Europe at the same time in the early 1990s. And she is, Anne Applebaum is a constant guest on NPR and on PBS. And she's always saying that Putin is about to lose. But at the same time, she's also saying that if Putin wins, if he takes over all of Ukraine, it's still his goal. And he stated that very recently in his conversation with Tucker Carlson. It's still his goal. Well, this woman, this sort of very sort of, I put her in the same category of Catherine Mayer. She said that Putin said that he still wants to take all of Ukraine. And this went out on PBS, and she's been saying very similar things on NPR. She's been boasting about how the Republicans under Mike Johnson have to surrender on the $61 billion aid package, and now that Ukraine just needs to push Russia out of Ukraine, and then all will be good. I mean, this totally fake narrative, I think, but maybe half the Washington blob still believes it, and she is one of the most vocal supporters of Ukraine. Well, the point is, I actually went through this Tucker Carlson interview, the entire interview. The transcript of it's available on the internet. You just have to type in transcript Putin Carlson. And he actually doesn't say anything of the sort. Rather, he says that he's ready for peace. He said, I'm just going to try and quote here, blah, 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 blah. He's also saying it's absolutely out of the question that he's going to, we have no interest in Poland, Latvia, or anywhere else. And he says that he is ready for peace as soon as America stops supplying weapons to Ukraine. There's not a single word anywhere about going to the whole of Ukraine, let alone invading the rest of Europe. So, you know, in other words, Anne Applebaum is not telling the truth there. And she, of course, has written lots of books about her former friends in Eastern Europe, who, like Orban and some of the people on the right in Poland, whom she thinks have betrayed liberalism and the Cold War victory that America had in favor of sort of the nostrums of the right. But in fact, they're the ones who seem to be more realistic, and she's clinging to old myths about. So she calls that fake news, but she is her purveying fake news herself. Well, anyway, I'd like to welcome Anne Applebaum onto the show to make her case, because NPR and PBS obviously not giving a pushback. Anyway, back to Walpurgis night, but I don't think she and Catherine will be flying away when the bonfires start up tonight. Anyway, enough of that. We've got our news political editor, Basil Valentine, on with us after a very quick break. This is the Pelinero Taylor Show on TNT News Talk. Back with a break.
Conversations to inform and include.
It's meant for everyday people to understand.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelinero Taylor Show. We've got Basil Valentine with us, political editor. What's in the news today, Basil?
Oh, well, the stakes are getting higher and higher, were it possible, Peli, in the Middle East, both on the ground in Rafah, in the diplomatic forum, and of course on American campuses, particularly at the one that started it all, Columbia University, where faculty have formed a ring fence defending the students, shouting, "To get to our students, you'll have to get through us," at riot police. All this has been roundly condemned by the House Speaker Mike Johnson, who has branded the protests an utter disgrace. I would have thought they were a natural expression of American democracy, something that he is supposed to be all in favour of. He's called for the resignation of University President Shafiq and claims that the campus is being overrun by anti-Semitic students and faculty alike, as if somehow out of nowhere, suddenly all these faculty, many of them Jewish, and students, almost most of them Jewish, suddenly, out of nowhere and for no obvious reason, anti-Semitic. They are, of course, objecting to the genocide in Gaza and the complicity, not just of the US government, who've aided and abetted it, facilitated it, but also their universities all over the country, who often have investments in weapons companies and take large endowments from foundations, individuals and organizations with close ties to Israel. Meanwhile, on the diplomatic front, there's a tense standoff, as if there hasn't been already, with the new ceasefire deal offered to Hamas, offering only really a period of calm for 40 days, which, given the biblical references made by the Israeli leadership. Of course, it's sort of interesting choice of number, 40 days. But no permanent ceasefire, which is what Hamas are demanding. So basically, the deal is the same as it's been for a long time, which is, you know, we will cease the bombardment for long enough to get the hostages out and then carry on with it. It's as simple as that. And meanwhile, we'll release some of the thousands of people that we've kidnapped over the last few months. There are also very disturbing reports of checkpoints being erected around Rafah, allowing women and children out, but not men of fighting age, prior to the all-out ground assault. And meanwhile, the area assaults, the bombings. I've heard of a bombing in one of the refugee camps there, where children, displaced children, are sheltering in place, and that was bombed overnight with more deaths and casualties. But Mike Johnson seems to think that all these teachers and students at Columbia are anti-Semitic, Pele. I mean, the way that word can just be dropped in, sort of parachuted in to, you know, slander, slur and smear people of good conscience is, it's ridiculous, really. I mean, it's, you know, it'd be very tempting to just call it stupid, but it's not just stupid, because people like Johnson know exactly what they're doing by using that term.
Yeah. Wasn't a few days ago in Britain, there was a case of a Mossad asset running around and taunting people, and then somebody criticized him, or the police took him for a Jew or something and said something, and then the media, he made a case against the police, and suddenly all the headlines were about what this policeman had said to this guy, who was an agent provocateur anyway. And all this made the headlines in the UK. And if you looked at the very bottom of the news scroll, you maybe saw this brief reference to the hospital slaughter. You know, I mean, talk about news standards, you know.
That's right. That was Gideon Falter, who represents the so-called campaign against anti-Semitism, which has been revealed by people like Professor David Miller and others to be little more than a front for the Israeli embassy, a very convenient way of setting up what superficially sounds like a entirely benevolent organization, but is in fact designed to combat Palestinian solidarity. And that's what Gideon Falter was trying to do. He was trying to disrupt the anti-genocide march. A policeman stopped him from crossing the road. Falter was wearing a yarmulke, and for the sin of pointing out to Falter that he looked obviously Jewish, Falter demanded not just the sacking of that police officer, but the resignation of the Metropolitan Police Commissioner as well. Well, it later transpired when a longer form footage of the altercation, I mean, really a minor altercation on a London pavement, when the longer form footage was released, it was obvious that Falter was indeed causing trouble, basically, and that he was flanked by Mossad heavies. His claim that he was innocently returning home from the synagogue was quickly debunked. He'd obviously gone there to try and cause an incident. But you're right, all the media oxygen for several days was taken up by this supposedly gross incidence of anti-Semitism on a part of an extremely patient and professional police officer. So much so that other senior figures, when they saw the footage, felt that Falter should really have been arrested for causing a public nuisance. But that is typical of the way the media reports what's going on. I mean, that's the case in the United States as well, with the campus protests, with, you know, phony victims from the tiny number of pro-Zionist Jewish students being amplified on American media, and the much larger number of Jewish anti-Zionist protesters completely ignored. But this has prompted articles. Saw one posted on X today by Zionist Jewish supporters in America, you know, really denouncing the anti-Zionist Jews as being the enemy, essentially. I'll get the details of that article up for the next hour. But the irony, of course, of that is that that is itself a form of anti-Semitism, right? I mean, to denounce any group of Jewish people en masse for the political position they hold is textbook anti-Semitism. But that's precisely what the Zionists do. So we end up in a circular firing squad like this. And the disappointing thing is that the important issues, which is ending the genocide, that's the key thing, the suffering of the Palestinian people and the United States facilitating it still endlessly, enthusiastically, that message gets very deliberately buried with all the condemnation. You know, loads of these talking heads on the so-called liberal networks, condemning the students out of hand, you know, no attempt really to understand. Very minor pushback on, of all places, The View, not my favorite program usually, but yeah, as usual, we, you know, you can't rely on the corporate media to find out what's going on. You've got to go to Today's News Talk, or to a lesser extent, social media.
That's right. Absolutely. If we if you hadn't had TNT and maybe Al Jazeera and maybe Middle East Eye and maybe other places, you don't know what much of the world knows. As said, we were used to, in people, if you lived in the Dresden area in the Cold War, you didn't get West German television. You were completely blind by communist propaganda. Well, we in the entire West are living in the Valley of the Blind, whatever you call it, in the Dresden Valley, as it were. Okay, thanks, Basil. We'll have you on in an hour's time to talk about further developments. But we've got our first guest coming up on Pelle Niroth-Taylor Show on TNT News Talk after a very quick break.
Johnny Vedmore, TNT.
It doesn't matter what you think about the Jewish people. If you don't agree with the IDF murdering women and children, then you are an anti-Semite, of course. This is an extremely dangerous game. Once upon a time, that word actually meant something quite powerful. Actually, it caused people to lose their jobs. It led to politicians losing elections. It led to people's lives being ruined, and sometimes even led to jail terms. Now, it leads to people saying, get lost. There is only a certain amount of times that you can accuse people of being something they're not. And in this situation, those times have definitely passed.
Johnny Vedmore on Today's News Talk, TNT. TNT is an independent global news talk station that does what others only say they do. TNT is a live radio and TV broadcaster that simply tells the truth 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. No one in the world does what we do, crisscrossing the globe, providing credible news and opinion all day and all night. In 2.5 years, TNT has become a credible and exciting platform with brilliant hosts and staff. It's a critical time, and we must continue to call out the misinformation and propaganda from mainstream media and their powerful sponsors. We're now appealing to our many friends and supporters around the world to go to tntradio.live and make a small donation to TNT while we seek the right investors to continue our important mission.
Listen up!
Now listen, we gotta talk.
It's what we do best.
This is Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Niroth-Taylor Show on this Tuesday afternoon. We've got Jessamine Dodd with us, who's a reporter at the Epoch Times. Harvey Weinstein was convicted of rape in 2020, and it's just been overturned by a New York Court of Appeals, citing prejudicial conduct, which included allowing women to testify about unrelated allegations. Now, this is interesting enough in itself, and we'll talk about that. But for those of us who think that Trump's been terribly badly treated by the American justice system, there might be ramifications for all the cases against Trump. So with us to talk about that is Jessamine. Welcome to the show, Jessamine, or Jess. If Trump didn't get a fair trial, how about Trump? What are the ramifications here, the consequences for all those Trump cases that we follow with bemusement in Europe?
Well, again, there are a lot of Trump cases. The New York District Attorney is definitely out to get Donald Trump. I want to point out, as you mentioned, Harvey Weinstein's conviction was overturned for his 2020 rape and also sexual assault, which occurred in 2016. They were tried together. That was overturned because they said the judge was prejudiced. Now, we've seen Judge Mershon in New York. He does not like Donald Trump. They cited prejudicial conduct, allowing testimony that wasn't related to the case. I think that now the prosecutors in New York are going to be very careful about who they let testify in this Donald Trump case, because they don't want to have his attorneys overturn it.
Right. Can we just go through the Weinstein case then? What was overturned then? I mean, a lot of people here barely know who the guy is. So maybe you can just give us some background.
Sure. So Harvey Weinstein, he was a media mogul, producer, and responsible for some of the biggest movies that you've seen, working with Quentin Tarantino, Miramax. He was the head of Miramax film studios, multi-award-winning producer. So he was tried in two separate states. He has the Los Angeles case where he was tried for sexual assault and rape, and he was convicted there and sentenced to 16 years, which he has not started serving because that was set after the New York trial, which he was also convicted of, a 2016 and 2020 rape. That was the one that was overturned. So what the thing that happened in that case was that the judge allowed people who were not part of the case to testify to his past behavior, to sort of set out a pattern of sexual abuse. They allowed Annabella Sciorra, the actress from The Sopranos, to testify that Harvey Weinstein had brutally raped her 25 years prior. Now, that statute of limitations had long passed and he wasn't tried for that case. And then in Los Angeles, they allowed the jury to hear that he had been convicted of rape in New York. So there was a lot of, basically what happened was the court said, hey, this judge allowed testimony to be heard, which shouldn't have been heard.
Right. So the parallel then in the cases of against Trump is that, everyone has a view of Trump, I guess, haven't they? So everyone brings a lot of prejudices to the table, and there might be this kind of cross-pollination of evidence. Is that right? Is that what the prosecutors fear that Trump's defense lawyers are going to use?
Absolutely. They fear that all of his, quote unquote, past behaviors, things that he's done in the past, things that he said, people who don't like him will be allowed to give testimony, and that the judge will allow it. Now, whether or not the judge will allow it, that remains to be seen. I think now with this Weinstein overturning, they're going to be extra, extra careful. We saw during the jury selection in New York, a lot of the jurors flat out said, I don't like Donald Trump. I think he's an awful person. And they were excused. It was very hard to pull a jury in New York. New York does not like Donald Trump. At one point, he was the king of New York, so to speak, with all of his real estate endeavors and starring on The Apprentice. And then during his presidency, people changed because New York is very Democratic. They always vote with a Democratic hand. And so it is going to be extremely hard for Donald Trump to get a fair trial in New York City.
Could you just remind us, or European audience, what this case against Trump is in New York? We've got two minutes before a news break.
Yes, of course. The case against Trump is a fraud case. It is alleging that he gave Michael Cohen, who, I don't know if you know anything about Michael Cohen, he already served time.
Yeah, he was Trump's lawyer and was involved in this Russiagate crap.
Correct.
Yeah.
And he did his time. He was in solitary confinement. And then when he got out, he turned on Trump and went on this whole anti-Trump tirade, as he does nightly on his TikTok live streams, talking about the case, which, again, might taint the case. Maybe. So Donald Trump was accused of funneling money through Michael Cohen to pay off Stormy Daniels, an adult film star who he allegedly had an affair with. He wanted to shut her up because she was going to. Now, this is all alleged. This is from Stormy, right? That she was going to come forward during his 2016 presidential run and say, hey, this guy had an affair with me while Melania was, nursing Barron. So he's not a good person. He shouldn't be running. He has no family values. This is what has been the narrative that they have spun. And so they're trying to prove that this money, which he allegedly wrote off as campaign funds, right? He's saying that it was sort of part of his campaign, was actually just hush money for an adult star.
But what part of that is illegal? We'll talk about that after the break. Unfortunately, we're going to go into a minute's news on the half hour, which we always have every day. This is Pelinero's Taylor Show on TNT News Talk. Back after the break with the latest on the Trump case.
What a news day this is turning out to be.
Wait till you hear this.
Now, TNT Radio News.
Matt Boylan here with your TNT headlines. There are fresh hopes of a ceasefire in Gaza as Hamas considers a new proposal for a 40-day truce tabled by Israel. Meanwhile, anger is rising in Tel Aviv, where anti-government protests have ramped up with a vengeance, calling for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to resign over his handling of the war. And AstraZeneca has for the first time admitted in court that its COVID-19 vaccine can cause a rare, deadly blood-clotting side effect.
The common housefly, caught in the clutches of the spider's web. Every move it makes just makes matters worse. Then, dinner time.
Feast on the captivating stories, videos, and helpful information on our website.
Whoa.
Dinner's ready.
Oh, man.
Escape is futile.
Just one more video.
Get stuck in our web.
TNTradio.live.
Welcome back to the Pelinero's Taylor Show. We've got a reporter from the Epoch Times, which is an excellent newspaper, by the way. They did a really good coverage of the election steal in 2020, I remember. Perhaps the only newspaper that did so. Jasmine Dodd, who's talking about Harvey Weinstein's 2020 rape conviction and the overturning of that, which might give some hope to Trump. But we're just going back into some background about this case against Trump in New York, against Stormy Daniels. And we were halfway through that. You're saying this he'd spent the money on her, listing it as campaign funds. And where is the alleged crime in that? Basically, it was kind of hush money because she was criticizing his family values if she was going to come out with that. But
So the crime would be that he wrote it as legal services to his attorney, Michael Cohen.
Right.
Not what it was for. So they're claiming that it's fraud. So he's saying that he's using this money to pay for legal services when it was actually to pay off Stormy. So that's what he's being charged with, is fraud and falsifying documents, legal documents.
Right. But and does Trump dispute that he's paid off Stormy Daniels?
Of course he says that he's never had an affair with her. He never paid her off. Right, he didn't do any of this stuff. And now today in court, we have Michael Cohen's banker who is testifying. So we'll be watching that. And Michael Cohen, again, is going to be taking the stand. He's going to be a key witness in this trial. It's going to be interesting to see what happens with Michael Cohen. He's such an interesting character. He has been on, the app TikTok every night, live streaming for 2 or 3 hours talking about Donald Trump. So and it's no secret how he feels about Trump. So where's his gag order? You know, everyone else in the case is getting a gag order, and this man's up here talking about everything he's talking about. I wrote Trump's playbook. I know exactly what he's doing. This is what happened. He's basically, if there's any kind of cause for a mistrial or have the case thrown out or have his testimony thrown out, I believe that's it.
Right. So then you're not allowed to do what he's doing, basically. But as a lawyer, he should know those things. It's extraordinary that he's sabotaging his own case. If he really wants to get Trump that much, he ought to know some of the basics of trials. But you think,
He will come on and say, I can't talk about the case, but then he'll talk about Donald Trump and start cursing and calling him these names. I'm not making this up. You can go on TikTok any night of the week, Monday through Friday, and watch him live stream on his channel. And sometimes he'll say, I can't talk about my exact testimony. I can't talk about the case, but he will talk about how much he hates Donald Trump. He wrote a book called Revenge.
Right.
Which is about Donald Trump and him going to court for Trump and going to jail, pardon me, for Trump. So this is a very interesting witness. We'll see what is going to be allowed from his testimony. Will Donald Trump's attorneys pull up recordings of Michael Cohen's live streams.
Well, I mean, unfortunately, I don't know anything about law, but why would that be illegal to do what he's Michael Cohen's doing? What's the name of the?
I mean, here's the thing: is Donald Trump? Yeah. You know, a lot of times in these high profile cases, they will give gag orders as not to to, you know, to in case you never know who's listening. You want to see people's their motives. You know, are they telling the truth? You know, could their testimony be anything but truthful? So it could possibly influence the case. It might influence the way that Trump's attorneys question Michael Cohen. If they bring this up at all, that he's been talking about it, they might not want a gag order. They might want Michael Cohen to talk.
Because the principle is that the jurors mustn't be affected by what goes on outside the courtroom and only listen to the evidence that goes on inside the courtroom. So he's polluting his own case, Michael Cohen, and Trump's defense might be able to use that, saying that the jurors might have tuned into the TikTok broadcasts and gotten their information from that.
That's right. Yeah, that's true. And, you know, in cases like this, you know, they always tell people who are, you know, other than the prosecutors, other than the people that are legal representation that know how to speak to the press, they might tell people that are involved, don't talk to the press, don't go live, don't make any posts, don't do anything, because we want this case to be airtight. Again, it'll be very interesting to see how it plays out. We're in week three of the Trump trial. His prosecutors, Donald Trump's attorneys may, you know, use this Harvey Weinstein thing, saying, you know, the judge prejudiced against Harvey. The judge was prejudiced. He wanted to get Harvey Weinstein. Judge Mershon wants to get Trump. So they might use this angle. It will be very interesting to watch how it plays out here in the American courts in New York City, of course.
Right. So we've got two or three minutes left. Maybe you just want to say something about the other case in Washington. Is that it's incredibly confusing for us who don't follow these things nonstop, you know, even though I'm quite favorable to Trump. But to me, it sounds like this carries a slight risk, this New York case. What about the Supreme Court case, I think it was, in Washington? Could you just summarize that? I think we're going to talk to other guests in more detail about it, but you can give us an hors d'oeuvre, if you like.
That's the hard part about Trump, is that, you know, when people say it is a coordinated attack, is what I've heard people say, because we have Washington, we have Georgia, we have the Georgia election interference, we have the January 6th, you know, he's been accused of inciting an insurrection. We have states trying to take him off the ballot so that people cannot vote for him here. And then we've got New York, we had the E. Jean Carroll case. I want to point out to your viewers that on the same day that Harvey Weinstein's conviction was overturned in New York, Donald Trump's attorneys, and I don't know if you know this, but his attorneys had petitioned to have E. Jean Carroll's defamation and sexual abuse and sexual battery case overturned for very similar reasons, and the judge denied it. So they let Harvey Weinstein walk free. And they denied Trump's, you know, they denied his to overturn his case. And that was a very troubling case to
exactly.
She didn't remember what day it was. She didn't remember what exactly happened. It was a long, long time ago. She had.
So may I ask, are you actually good? Do you actually get, are you based in New York? Are you going into the courtroom every day? Are you following this closely? Because we can have you on again shortly.
I would love to come on. I'm not based in New York. I'm on the West Coast, but I am following this case. I've been covering, again, Harvey Weinstein. I do politics. Right now, I just covered, again, we have Gerard Depardieu was just arrested in France for sexual abuse and sexual battery.
Oh, my God.
More than a dozen women. So he's in custody there. And of course, we've got Andrew Tate, which I'm covering, the influencer going to trial in Romania. So I have my hands in a lot of these celebrity legal cases, and I'd love to come back.
Well, love to have you on. Celebrity and politics, maybe it's just the same thing. Or we'll talk about that with Hollywood. Politics is the new Hollywood, or Hollywood is the new politics. Okay, thanks a lot, Jasmine Dodd, a reporter at Epoch Times and writes a lot about Trump and Harvey Weinstein and other sexual abuse cases. Love to have you on again. This is the Pelinero's Taylor Show. We're going to go into our second guest very shortly after a very quick break. Thanks.
When a crisis hits, close to home, and across the globe, nonprofits are on the front lines, ready to serve.
Keep coming.
The demand for charitable services has skyrocketed, and nonprofits are rising to meet the needs. Healing. Nurturing. Rescuing. Honoring. Protecting. Caring. Inspiring. The work of philanthropic organizations of all sizes, across all missions, has never been more important. And it's donors and volunteers like you who make all this possible. Thank you. Together, we change the world. The Nonprofit Alliance.
She used to dance and dream of a better life. A brighter future. Today, thanks to Children International and friends like you, she dances for the world. Together, we give children in poverty a chance to set their sights high and achieve their dreams. Learn more about Children International and join us in our life-changing work at children.org today.
Pella Nuroth-Taylor, live from Sweden, on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pella Nuroth-Taylor Show. For our second guest on this afternoon, it's Professor Ulla Tunander, who's a professor emeritus at the Peace Research Institute in Oslo, Norway, a great friend of mine. He's one of the foremost experts on intelligence operations of the Cold War and written and edited 12 books and written numerous articles on security politics, naval strategy, submarine operations, geopolitics, and psyops. He was a research professor, and he's going to talk to us a little bit about Ukraine and the latest developments there. One of the most affecting things, I'd say, in your recent Substack article, Ulla, was how you described a new cemetery is being constructed in Kiev or outside Kiev with enough room for 150,000 graves. Now, if you go by a lot of assessments of the death toll of young men in Ukraine, that's going to fill up pretty quickly because of the America's support, continued support of $61 billion to Ukraine. What's going on now in Ukraine? Ulla, what do you think, given your 50-year experience of studying these things?
Yeah, no, I would say that, I mean, this cemetery outside Kiev is just one cemetery. So it's a huge cemetery outside Kharkiv or in Kharkiv, actually, which is, endless of Ukraine flags. And then you have other cemeteries also, so it quite a few. I mean, so that's it's several hundred thousand dead, that you could say for sure. And the Russian says that it's 500,000 dead, and there's a Polish general recently said it was more than 500,000 dead. Anyway, it's quite a few people, and one problem. Now, if you look at what Jens Stoltenberg, the General Secretary of NATO, what he said yesterday was that we have to support, Ukraine is losing the war, and we have to support them so they will be able to win the war. That was his argument. And what he didn't say, that they didn't have enough people, enough soldiers. They're losing also, they're losing because of they haven't enough artillery shells, but they're also losing because they have not enough soldiers. And many young men in Ukraine are hiding. So they are, they don't want to go to the war. I mean, the military advisor for, or former military advisor for Zelensky, he said that 4.5 million men hadn't registered. You couldn't reach them. And many of these people are in the Western countries. And now the embassy says, we will not prolong your passport because you are, if you don't come to Ukraine and fight in the war. So that's it's a Western countries actually supporting Ukraine with a huge amount of weapons, but the many people don't want to fight.
Yeah, it seems like the manpower problem is overwhelming, but also shells. I mean, I've been reading up a lot on this, and the West doesn't seem to have the manufacturing capacity. So, I mean, what if we brought a pro Ukraine can win this commentator? There's a guy called Larry Friedman in England. A lot of my acquaintances and friends think he's a military guru, and he says, "Well, Ukraine is going to win in 2025 because, you know, this $60 million is going to $1 billion is going to support them until then, and then they're going to rearm and remobilize." And then there are other support sources saying that we, even with the best will in the world, the West and America can't manufacture the number of shells available. And of course, there's a mobilization problem. I mean, there's a report in Marianne, a French magazine, saying that from the French intelligence, obviously that was a shot across the bows against Macron when he wanted to send in French troops, and it sounded honest and genuine. And it's in the very well-known political magazine saying, you know, you can't, we can do 3D printers of a lot of electronic stuff the Ukrainians need, but we can't do 3D printers for human beings. There are simply not enough people there. So it seems that there really aren't enough people, and there isn't even a large enough number of shells. What do you think what is NATO's motivation for continuing this war, and America's motivation? Are they hoping, do you think they honestly hope to win this and think they're going to win this, or are they just trying to harass the Russians?
I think the latter is most important. I mean, among people who really know the situation, they know that Ukraine can never win against Russia. Russia has 140 million inhabitants. Ukraine had 40 million, but now maybe actually 20 million that they could use, and including women and so on. I mean, there is lots of people have left the country, and so there is no way in the prolonged war that Ukraine could win. And also, CNN had an article recently saying that Russia produces three times more artillery shells than the total Western world could produce. So it's not possible, I think. I mean, now they are trying to send in huge amount of drones and so on to, but it will not be enough. I mean, that's in the final analysis, it comes down to industrial capacity, and if you are able to change the industrial capacity to a wartime industry, so this is and the West won't do that.
Okay, but there are some pro-NATO commentators in the West. I mean, there's some hawkish people who say, yeah, the West, Russia is an economy the size of Italy, a gas station with nukes. We in the West, if we mobilize our will, we can defeat Russia by creating a war economy. Do you think the West can do that, or they just don't want to do it? There's no political will to do it.
No, I think it's wrong with this parallel with a medium European country with a gas station. So I mean, that's it's obvious that the sanctions have shown that Russia survived these sanctions. I mean, it actually has been much harder for example, Germany. So it's you could say also that the war is directed not just against Russia, but against Germany, and accordingly also against Europe. So the one who is winning the war is United States. So it's and of course they will try to weaken Russia. I mean, that was a statement by Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin. I mean, he said the US idea was to weaken Russia. And before the upcoming war with China, that was what the Harald Kujat, the German former chairman of NATO Military Committee, said, and former chief of the German Defense Forces. So it's
sorry. And what did he say?
He said that one should that NATO policy now, or US policy, was to weaken Russia before the upcoming war with China. So I mean, the point would be to take out Russia before you start the war with China.
And maybe access, how much credence do you give to the theory that the West wanted to turn Russia into sort of a five little Ukraine with five little Zelensky vassal figures and use that to control this enormous resources of Eurasia and use that to sustain the West for another generation and maybe use that to take on China and use it more? Because Russia has a lot of resources, but it might not be used as effectively and efficiently as if the West took control over it.
Yeah, I don't know. It's clear that Richard Cheney, the former defense secretary and vice president and so on, he wanted to split up Russia, not just Soviet Union at the time, but he wanted to split up Russia in small pieces. And that, I think, that was written by Robert Gates, later Secretary of Defense. And this was what Cheney argued in 1991, in autumn 1991, that one should not just try to split up the Soviet Union into its many republics, but also to split up Russia, because it was too big. And US don't want to have other countries that are too big, you know.
Do you think that in your version, it's a war against both Germany and Russia, and it's the old Anglo sea powers old trick of displacing or reducing all the potential rivals and hegemons, and especially above all the alliance between Russia and Germany, this friendship that was cemented most recently in the energy friendship, if you like. But I mean, it happened before World War One and World War Two, this fear of German know-how in alliance with Russian resources, creating this continental hegemon. And I think in some ways we were going towards that in the 2010 to 2020 period with Schroeder's friendship with Russia. The Chinese were building their Belt and Bridge Road. And so there was a kind of coalescence of a German, Russian, Chinese friendship where the Anglos, especially after the Brits left with Brexit, self-sabotaged their own geopolitical position, and the Americans were sitting there. But I have to say, so it makes sense for the Anglos to use Poland and Ukraine as a sort of to weaponize ancient nationalisms of that region to keep Germany and Russia apart. But it seems that the opinion formers in America are much more anti-Ukrainian than in Britain or in Sweden. So in as much as there is opposition to this escalating war, it comes from America. And the Americans seem more cautious about escalating than the British are. So Doesn't that go against a little bit your theory that it's the Americans are doing all the running on this war?
Yeah, I think they started, but the Brits go further. That's for sure. I think the Americans still have some realism when it comes to nuclear weapons. I mean, they know that it could become a nuclear war, and it will destroy United States tremendously. So it's they don't want to trigger this. While a lot of there was one guy called Donnelly who was an advisor for Thatcher for a while and then for NATO, and he's argued that there is no risk of nuclear escalation because to talk about nuclear weapons is just a problem because then we don't dare to do things really. So it's and true. I don't think that the Russians are willing to escalate to nuclear war if it's not really very, 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 very dangerous situation for them. But the question is, what will the Europeans do? What will the Brits do? So and if the Brits, if they hit attack Murmansk, the naval bases at Murmansk, for example, what will Russia do in that case? Will they hit Portsmouth? And so it's
how would they attack Murmansk with missiles, with storm shadows?
No, also with a missile from a submarine. That they could do. I mean, I am not saying that it will happen, but but I think that the Americans are more cautious in this case than the British. That's my point.
This $61 billion legislative law that was passed that is going to give Ukrainians a lot of hope, and some of the warmongers in the West, Anne Applebaum was saying, "Oh well, we've won this. All the Putin lovers in Congress, they're on the defensive. Now let's just make sure that Ukraine gets the money to win." And so it's like we're back in charge, we're back in business, and it seems to be, I don't know. They're living in another world, as far as I'm concerned. But why do you think that? I was just reading a lot about Nixon and Vietnam, and how Nixon was planning to do peace. He just wanted to do it after he'd won the election of 1968. Do you think Biden and company are completely beholden to the hawks, or are they want peace, but a peace after they've been reelected? Are there any peace measures going on, do you think?
I think they, not now, but I think if it gets really worse for the Ukraine side, they have to find a solution to it. And it's not unlikely. I mean, you could say that they will get these weapons and these artillery shells and so on in not too distant future and so on. But still, I doubt that they have lost very much. And I think it was Kuyat, this German general, who said that the Gallup polls in Ukraine now strongly support a negotiated solution and so on. And that they actually they don't want to win the war. I mean, in the West, in Norway and Sweden, the governments want to win the war, but the people who are fighting don't want to win the war any longer,
Because what would they win? They would just win a Russian-speaking part of Ukraine that's pro-Russian anyway, then they'll have an endless guerrilla warfare. Being one of Europe's poorest countries, what's the point? I mean, this whole thing is so stupid anyway. Why don't you just keep out of areas that don't want to have you and stay in areas that want that are yours. Isn't that just the easiest solution for everyone?
Because, you know, it was clear from the beginning that the Russian wanted a neutral Ukraine. That's what they said. And that's what they accepted.
Ula, sorry, we ran over a little bit there. I shouldn't have started on this new topic. Ula Tunanda, professor at the Peace Research Institute in Oslo and Scandinavia's best commentator on international affairs. Thank you very much. I'll have you on again soon. We'll be back after the news and other things for our second hour on this Tuesday afternoon. Thank you very much. This is Fellaini Roth Taylor Show.